Welcome, dear hunters, managers, and enthusiasts. This is Deer University, the podcast of the Mississippi State University Deer Lab. My name is Bronson Strickland.
And I'm Steve Damaris. Bronson and I are professors of wildlife management and co-directors of the MSU Deer Lab. Together, we've researched deer across the United States for more than 40 years. In our podcasts, we explain the why and how of deer management based on science, whether it's research we've conducted or explaining research done elsewhere. We'll offer you a college course in the science of deer management.
But don't let Steve scare you. This isn't going to be a review of calculus or chemistry. Instead, we take results of research, reduce it to what's important, and explain how you can apply research to management. So join us for this episode of Deer University. Welcome back to the next episode of Deer University. Steve, you called this meeting today. You called the podcast. What are we going to talk about?
Well, here's the deal, Bronson. It's midsummer. Hot temperatures starting to dry out. Habitat quality is tanking because of drought, hot temperatures. It's been months since spring green up. And the needs of the animals are not tanking. They're actually increasing. We've got bucks that are finishing out growing their antlers. We've got does that are in late-term gestation and going into early lactation. Extremely nutritionally demanding time of the year. Do our listeners understand this? And have they prepared for it in advance?
I would venture to guess that most people don't understand that, especially in the South, because it's green outside now. It looks like there's plenty of food. But as you taught in your classes 30, 40 years ago, maybe.
Go ahead.
That's unique.
Been that recent?
He may have chiseled it out in stone tablets. Mm. Maybe that'll.
Well, it's still around then, probably.
Yeah, we could dig them up. That in the South, we have two nutritional limitations. Two times of the year really important. You know, we always think of the winter time in the North, of course, is very severe. Deer survival can be in jeopardy depending on winter severity. And although we don't have the severity issues in the South, it's still nutritionally limited. But what we also have is late summer, for the very reasons you described. When we get towards the end of the summer, the temperatures are hot, the plants have stopped growing as rapidly. So our concentrate selector, our picky eater, where the deer is going around and only picking the most succulent digestive pieces of the plant, they're not growing as much. So that's not as available. And so we end up with a time of year when deer need high-quality nutrition the most because of gestation, because of upcoming lactation demands, because bucks are growing antlers, and there can be a deficit on the landscape with nutrition.
Absolutely.
So that's what you want to talk about today.
Yes, and then Marcus is going to talk about how he can fix that with habitat management.
Yep. I like what you said. It's green outside. It looks like there's a bunch of good stuff to eat. But most people don't realize that plants naturally start senescing, especially forbs, during right now.
What does senescing mean?
Senescing means that it's stopped growing and it's starting to decline.
Kind of like me. Go ahead.
It's mobilizing nutrients. If it's a perennial plant, to the root system. If it's an annual, a large portion of them have already flowered. They're putting energy into producing seed. The main thing from a deer manager's perspective is the plants are not sequestering nutrients in the leaf tissue that the deer is going to eat.
Because anymore. They're not actively growing anymore.
Absolutely. So
they're over the hill, like Damaris. Yeah. They've slowed down.
The leaf tissue is just declining in quality, and it will continue that until fall.
So many good jokes there, Steve.
But we don't want to take up our listeners' time in excess joking about my physical condition.
This is a deer podcast.
That's right.
Okay, Marcus, so what can people do this time of year? So let's take it from two perspectives. what should someone have done several months ago? Mm-hmm. And if someone's listening right now, what can they do?
Okay. Well, first, I like to think about this from the deer's perspective. They've been around a long time. Why in the world do you think they would have their peak requirements when things are declining and poor? Anybody have a good answer for that?
Well, it depends on where you are in the world and latitude. Mm-hmm. Up north, they're producing their young earlier in the growing season.
Mm-hmm.
For a couple of different reasons. So it's not so out of sync up north.
Right.
But it is really out of sync down south.
That doesn't make a lot of sense, does it?
Unless you think about historically, and this is where you're going.
Oh, yeah.
I'll throw in. Gee, Marcus, when did disturbance typically happen in the south historically?
Yeah. Well, I appreciate that, bone. You know I'm going to talk about fire every time I get on here. And most people don't realize that lightning generated fire. Most lightning strikes occur in July, but the optimal conditions for lightning to set things on fire is in June. So if you have a June fire, think about what happens to the plants. Now, they were all growing actively, and they were starting to flower for some species, and then you have this fire come through that top kills all the plants. So what has just now happened? We just reset succession. So that same plant turns into a mineral stump by fire and starts actively growing, but now it's behind, so it starts actively growing very quickly. But a large portion of the biomass is active growing tissue, and that delayed phenology that was caused by fire would push that nutrient-dense tissue later into the summer when deer could take advantage of it.
Well, just curious, why were the optimal conditions in June versus July? Is that
it's a combination of how dry it is. So we typically have more drought during June, and also with flash density. So how many lightning strikes are you getting? So you can imagine you want a lot of lightning strikes for some of them to cause fire. And also the drier it is when lightning strikes, the more likely that strike will cause fire. So there's an optimal situation, which is sort of right before the peak in lightning, before starting to rain a lot, and also you're still getting enough strikes during that dry weather that it generates fire. So the peak in fire is a little bit before the peak in lightning.
So Mother Nature provided, during the middle of the summer, when mm-hmm. antlers were growing and fawns were in the midst of gestation, there used to be a source.
Yeah, widespread.
Abundant nutrients.
Yeah, almost all of the systems in the South, all of the ecosystems, no matter what the plant community, were at least influenced, and some of them are completely dependent on fire.
Well, Steve, what time, so right now we're at the end of June, and when this is released, it'll be the beginning of July. Where are we at on the antler cycle with bucks?
Well, antler growth begins about 3 to 4 weeks after the antlers are dropped, and so In the South, we're talking about dropping antlers in mid-February, early March. And so by the end of March, bucks are growing their new antlers. And that initial process of growth is important, but it's supported by the spring green-up. And so I'm not as concerned about that process. But the early growth of the antlers is supported by the spring green up, but now between June, July, and August, you've got about 60% of the total antler growth of new tissue in the antlers taking place. And so you have a dramatically increased amount of protein. 50% of a completed antler is made out of protein. The other 50% is minerals. And so if you've got 60% of the growth of the antlers taking place in June, July, and August, where's that protein and where's that mineral coming from in a senescent plant community?
An over-the-hill.
An over-the-hill plant community.
Yeah.
So antlers are, you know, if I haven't made the point yet, antlers are nutritionally demanding growth processes during June, July, and August. Simultaneous to this, you've got does in late gestation, and birth dates, spawning dates vary across the Southeast. They vary within 100 miles of each other in the Southeast. We've got these pockets of strange breeding dates and fawning dates. But during the last 2 months of gestation, which is anywhere from May, June, June, July, depending upon where you are, you've got about a 4 or 5-fold increase in the daily requirement of those fetuses for protein. So you've got this huge increase in the demand of the growing fetuses for protein happening when the habitat quality is tanking because of the senescence of the plants. And let's blend now into once the fawns are produced, you have the demand of lactation, which again is a huge increase in the needs for protein and energy in the life of the doe. And ultimately producing a quality buck fawn that's going to grow antlers and be a product that you might want to harvest in about 6 years. Some of our work we haven't even talked about, Bronson, from years ago, looking at cohort effects and how weather conditions and habitat quality 1 year affects the expression of antlers at 2 years of age. Really interesting stuff, which we'll have to do a podcast on that.
That's weather and climate and stuff like that. We got to devote a whole issue to that.
Definitely deserves a podcast.
Yeah. So, but summarize, because we know I tend to get rambling sometimes. You need to be worried about what your animals need nutritionally now. Antler growth, gestation, and lactation.
In terms of what the deer need right now is when they need it, when you should be worried about it, was probably a month or two ago, at least.
Absolutely.
If you were going to do something about it, it should have been on the calendar months ago.
So to get back to your original question, what do we do about it? Well, there, one obvious one, we keep talking about it over and over, and I insist that we talk about it, seems like every time, is, you know, burning. That's a really important practice for deer. You know, they've been living with fire for a long time, and that just that month or so delay in plant phenology with those nutrients is very important because of when their lactation and antler growth needs are relative to the plant nutrition on the landscape. So that fire is pretty important, but they're not all lost. There's still something you could do right now. I'm not talking about supplemental feeding because we talked about that in the last podcast. It takes deer a little bit of time, even if you do that, to learn to eat it. They probably won't utilize it enough right now. If you went out tomorrow and did this, they probably won't utilize it enough to make a big benefit. But something they already know to eat are leaves. So we're sort of on the tail end of it, but right now it's still a pretty good time to go and cut down some trees and create some of these mineral stumps. I haven't been seeing a deer response to it until about 3 or 4 weeks after we cut them down. So you're sort of getting into, you know, you've missed a little bit of your window if you hadn't done it in the past few weeks already. But that doesn't mean you can't still gain some benefit. We did have deer on these mineral stumps within weeks of cutting them down. So that's still an option. I would suggest if the listeners have failed to plan ahead, it's still a pretty good time to go cut down a tree.
Get the chainsaw out.
Yeah.
Let me ask you something, Marcus, that should be very useful to people. You talk a lot about fire.
Yep.
Why is fire not used as much on the landscape now, number one? Why do we not burn as often as maybe historically? Number two, why do people typically not burn during June?
Well, that's actually probably the same answer to both of those. I guess the short answer is people. So a lot of our land managers now or landowners either didn't grow up using fire because they're a fairly young landowner, or it's been since they were a kid when they were using it. So not a lot of landowners have experienced fire, but one of the reasons it's being phased out is because of population growth of people. People don't like smoke. People who grew up in cities don't know about the benefits of fire. You know, the liability associated, especially with smoke, is really limiting, or at least that perceived liability. We actually can get a burn permit that is designed to protect the landowner from issues with that, as long as you stay within that permit. And that's the main reason, is this almost a fear. And to take that a step further, burning when lightning wants to burn things is harder to control. You have drier conditions. It's often storms associated with summer make the conditions to control smoke and the fire behavior more difficult, which is the same reason nature burned then. It was a more volatile time. So people typically avoid that time because of that.
What would you recommend if we have a listener wherever they're at and they wanted to learn, to be educated on how to become a prescribed burn manager?
Well,
what would you recommend they do?
There are several different kinds of programs. One is there's a federal program that they can get what's called a Red Card certification, and you go through a couple of different classes to get that. And then all state agencies have a prescribed burn manager training. So I would suggest going through both of those programs.
And then that certifies you to burn, number one, and then you're taught when you can, and you're taught the format where on the day you want to burn, you can contact the authorities and you can get a blessing.
Yep.
And all that to mean that if you're concerned about the legalities of burning, if you become a prescribed burn manager, you'll realize that you have a lot more flexibility with burning. And in terms of coverage liability, you're covered a lot more than most people think.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a good thing to go through both educationally and to
cover your backside. In Mississippi, you have to have a permit for burning, and that requires you to develop a plan for that burn and to have a prescribed burn manager on site when you burn. So as long as you have those things and you burn within the conditions, if something happens, it's designed to protect you, that liability. And also, a lot of people don't realize we have a state wildlife agency here, and we have them in other states with professionals that burn frequently, and they help landowners do that.
They like to burn.
Oh, yeah. Fire is so important to wildlife that all wildlife agencies, especially in the Southeast, have many people who specialize in that practice.
Well, you know, one thing on my end that I've always seen and said is that there's so many deer hunters and want to be, think they're managing deer habitat and deer nutrition that plant cool season food plots.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the biggest issues for people that I see is they're misled. They think they're doing a lot of good nutritionally, that they're raising diet quality for the deer herd with a few food plots in the fall and winter. And every little bit can help. Mainly, those plots increase deer observation rate. They increase harvesting rate, and all that is fantastic and wonderful. But there is really two different types of hunting clubs I and we work with. There's the ones that plant fall plots, and then there's the serious hunting clubs that are really trying to manage for older bucks, more quality bucks, trying to raise diet quality, and they plant warm season food plots.
Provided they listen to us.
That's right.
Well, and another thing about the warm season plots, most of those plants that you're using, like soybeans or cowpeas or whatever, are peaking in their production during that stress period we're talking about.
Exactly.
That's why that's critical.
Yeah, that is a very important characteristic of a warm season plot, is that you provide high quality nutrition during this time when it's poor.
And what you can do when you're working with a land manager, and you got to have some acreage. What I'm about to describe can be difficult. And when I say acreage, I don't mean total hunting area. I mean acreage for food plots. And so if you're leasing land and you're only provided 2 or 3 acres of openings, it's difficult to do this. But you can literally, if you plan accordingly, you can always have high quality forage in terms of food plots on the landscape. So And again, we're going to devote many episodes in the future to food plots and food plot strategies and so forth. But with the right fall mix that's composed of cereal grains and clovers, and there's a lot of other options too, but real simply, cereal grains respond immediately. Clovers respond, but they really don't come into their own growth-wise. They spend more time developing roots during hunting season than they do above-ground forage or biomass. But you have those clovers really growing strongly in the summer, and then that blends right into planting for your warm season plots. So a lot of mistakes we see people make is, on the same piece of ground, they plant their cool season, and then they want to disc it up or spray it with glyphosate and plant their warm season. And if you do that, you're going to miss a good 2 months. Mm-hmm. By the time you kill it, disc it up, then replant, you know, and the forage gets of sufficient height, you're going to miss 2 months. So what we try to do is you have some areas designated for cool season and some areas designated for warm season. And if you do that, you literally, you don't miss a month. You literally will not miss 12 months out of the year. You're going to be providing forage. And so, you know, Marcus, with forest management, if you're one of these people that leases land and mm-hmm. you can't do mineral stumps and yep. you can't thin the forest, that is one way that would be the most cost-effective way versus supplemental feeding to provide yeah. year-round nutrition.
Yeah, you absolutely will have a more cost-effective impact on your deer herd by strategically planting cool season and warm season. And I like what you said. We tend to think about the cool season as providing forage during the hunting season, and a lot of the cereal grains do that really well, but when you're planting these mixes with the clovers in, most of the forage production isn't during the hunting season, and I think that's missed by a lot of people. They don't realize, oh, all of that clover that I planted isn't really making that big impact until turkey season, really.
That's exactly right. And again, we don't want to steal too much of our thunder for our food plot episodes, but what's going to be real important for that, too, to realize all the biomass yield of that clover is using the appropriate herbicide and controlling mm-hmm. those springtime, you know, grasses.
Yep.
So when the clover is really wanting to grow, we want to make sure they're not competing with broadleaf weeds and, mm-hmm. and grasses. One thing I can say also relative to food plots right now that you can do and should be doing is you need to be taking soil samples.
Mm-hmm.
So even though you planted last year and you think you had a successful cool season plot, we're going to be showing some graphs in the upcoming weeks from mm-hmm. our student Jacob Dykes, that's finishing up his master's degree, and he has some we thought were very eye-opening results
yeah.
of when you follow the soil test versus when you don't, in terms of both the yield. Can't say you almost doubled yield, but on some of our plots, the yield was certainly double mm-hmm. when you followed the recommendation. And we even on some of these plants saw differences in the crude protein.
Yeah.
So more biomass and a greater ratio.
And I suspect some of the other important nutrients that are mobile in the plants. We haven't looked at that yet, but I suspect we also will see a difference in, you know, just the overall nutritional characteristics of the plant will be better.
I bet we will. So right now you need to start thinking, if you're in an area and if you're in the south, you most likely have acid soils. If you have any clay, you're going to have some acid soils. It takes a while for lime to neutralize the soil. So the cheapest way to do it is to go, well, first of all, get your soil test, get your recommended amount of lime you need. Go to a bulk distributor. Around here we say go to the co-op or go mm-hmm. to the feed and seed store, but go somewhere that offers ag lime and get it delivered and distributed on your food plots, and then disc it in so you can get that lime within the first few inches of the soil, and so it can begin neutralizing within the root zone of the plants. So if you want something to do during the summer that's going to benefit your fall food plots, soil test number one, if you need lime, get on it.
It's so cheap to get a soil test. most people are riding around out on their property to take a look anyway.
Yeah.
You may as well take one.
Yeah.
Spend a few dollars to that can save you so much money. And, you know, I work with people and have even done it myself where you have just some specific amount of fertilizer. You just go pour out that amount every year. And sometimes that's two or three times the amount you actually need. You know, it just depends on where you're at and what's been happening on that dirt. But
and if the acidity is off, the availability of that fertilizer that you put out, you know, it might not even be available even though you're dumping it there.
Yeah, once you start getting down, especially in the 5 range of the pH, a lot of those nutrients are bound up in the soil, and even if you put them there, the plant can't get them.
Yeah, they become, even though they're in the soil, the plant physiologically can't take it up because of the chemical reactions that occur in the roots. They literally don't have access to it.
Yeah, it's just bound up and not available.
You know what I've seen over the years too with people that just never soil test and just, hey, we're going to throw out 2 or 3 bags of triple 13 on top. Sometimes when I finally twist their arm to take a soil test, you will see some of these elements like phosphorus particularly, it'll be very, very high.
Yeah, so I've seen them when they were in excess, which means that they're deleterious to plants at this point.
So the pH was really, really low, and they're dumping all this phosphorus on there, but the plants weren't able to use it, and maybe it was accumulating. So there's one reason there, but the other side of that coin is economics. Why are you paying for 1/3 of that fertilizer and phosphorus when you didn't need it?
Fertilizers become more and more expensive. A lot of the fertilizers are, you know, produced associated with oil products, petrochemicals, and I don't understand how that happens, how they do that, but I understand gas and oil prices affect fertilizer prices.
Mm-hmm.
And you're just throwing good money after bad.
Affects ammonium nitrate, those prices.
Yeah.
Soil tests, absolutely prerequisite to a really high-quality food plot.
So what do you guys think about the relative influence of fall food plots versus summertime or warm season food plots? So, Steve, you just mentioned that we got all these things going on during the summertime physiologically. Antlers are growing. Fawns are being developed. Soon thereafter, lactation demands. Are hunters doing that much in terms of improving nutrition that will translate into either larger antlers, bigger bodies, more fawns by only planting fall food plots or cool season food plots?
They're not wasting their money because they're going to see deer potentially on the food plots, and they're going to, if it's a properly planned and grown food plot, it's going to help the animals get through the winter. And, you know, we know that bucks are going to lose 20-25% of their body weights during the rut. So having post-rut recovery nutrients available from the clovers or late developing protein-rich forages from the cool season plots can be of great value. But if I was going to invest my money in looking at return on investment, I want to invest it in warm season food plots, and then I'm going to hunt wherever I can find deer, look for trails in the woods, and get the heck away from cool season food plots completely.
You're going to get the heck away from them?
Heck yeah. If you only have so many acres on your property to plant food plots, plant warm season food plots and learn to hunt in the woods if you don't already know how to do it.
Sounds like the sage from the old man there, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Getting on to people. Well, I would probably modify that a little bit. I would probably say, well, I agree with you. So scientifically, if I'm going to measure time and money put into growing plants that will translate into changing a deer's reproductive output, antler growth, body weight, there's no argument there. But for a little bit of money, I would say on that same acreage that you had devoted to warm season, you could probably go over top with some cereal grains really, really cheap and get some growth that you would have. You know, I would want to disc it up entirely, depending on how productive that warm season plot was. Well, you know, think of Midwestern people, too. A lot of them aren't hunting over food plots, per se, in October or November. They're still hunting on the warm season plot, the old bean field that was harvested, the old corn field that was harvested.
That's right.
So that's kind of what I think you're referring to as well, is that could still be maybe providing some food via grain or not.
I'm thinking about a warm season food plot with some forage soybeans, for example, that I've seen deer eating abundantly through into November until the first freeze down around here, which you know, might not even happen until December.
Yeah, we watched the same thing with deer veg last year.
Yeah.
In fact, we had a really bad drought. Folks in Mississippi probably already know from last fall, and a lot of our cool season plots failed. But we still had deer veg from the previous summer carrying over all the way to the first frost, and deer were absolutely crushing those things during bow season in particular.
I do remember that, and let's clarify what deer vetch is, because there's a lot of vetches out there. Mm-hmm. Deer vetch is also called American joint vetch, and it's also, I guess, the Latin is Ashinomini on that. So
can you spell that?
I cannot spell it. Nope, I'm not going to try. Starts with an A.
Yeah.
I know that part.
It's close enough for me.
But that was the big lesson for us, is that we had on a research property there, we had a lot of the deer vetch planted, and it kept going and growing, you know, of course, all through the summer, and kept going through the drought. And even though we planted at our normal times, be it, you know, sometime in October, we didn't have cool season forages until it was December, wasn't it?
I don't think we took a biomass measurement until January.
Until end of January, yes. Yeah, so
that was well on into the season.
Yeah. So those warm season plants like that, yeah, they're going to slow down and they're going to pull a Damaris and maybe Sinas a little bit. But at least they're still there.
Yep.
I'm nodding my head.
Well, you're in agreement.
You know, and talk about the cool season again. You know, there are some clovers that aren't actually peaking until you get into May or even June. And there are a couple of different mixes. And of course, we're going to talk about this in another podcast in detail. But some of those mixes where you're getting 10 or 11 months out of a cool season food plot, what do you think about those? Because those could be producing a lot of forage during that critical time in the summer.
I think early summer. I can't imagine midsummer or late summer, but I'm not the food plot guy either.
It's better than nothing.
Yeah.
So if you were only going to do, you know, a little bit and you go out and broadcast cereal grains and fertilizer, you're going to get a response. You're going to have some green forage out there and deer are going to eat it. But the next step up for that is now adding springtime forages, which are typically clovers around here. Add that in, and now you went from 3 to 4 months to 6 to 7 months you're providing forage, and that's with a cheap clover.
Mm-hmm.
Now you start adding in some of those more specialty clovers, and now you're getting into 9 months, and if you add in one like red clover, you'll get into easily 10 months out of the year. But still, when you get, even though like red clover exists, and, you know, when I'm riding back and forth home, I still see red clover on the side of the road right now.
Yeah.
It's still not producing the amount of biomass that a true warm season food plot is.
Yeah, you're not like a forage soybeans where you're getting thousands and thousands of pounds per acre. It's certainly not producing the same amount of protein.
So you think about how you've kind of got your bases covered with that one planting. It's pretty cool, that one planting that you do in September, October, depending on where you're at, will carry most of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you can just carve out a few places on your property to use something like soybeans or cowpeas or deer vetch. I love our combo of deer vetch and Alice clover. It's almost foolproof. It's almost deer density proof. It can't kill it. Not as good quality forage, but it comes up and deer can't kill it, and they eat it. But now, right during the time Steve is talking about late summer, that's when we've added some really high quality foods on the landscape.
That's right.
So that's the way to address it.
So pairing those two together, that's when you really, that huge peak in biomass in the warm season plots occurs when that cools, even that really good cool season plot starts senescing during the midsummer. You have that huge peak in that warm season plant. So yeah, I think that's the way to do it if you can.
Now couple that with if you can burn, and then on top of that add in, if you're out there creating some mineral stumps along the way, or you're burning maybe causing some mineral stumps as well.
Now we're talking about substantially increasing the quality of the diet of all the deer.
So, Steve, we get back now to our epigenetics from a few years ago. That's the time during gestation. That is when potentially those epigenetic switches are being turned on and off, the condition of that mother, sending signals to those fetuses. So that's when you can start flipping some switches.
Yeah. So if we haven't already made the point and get people to understand, you need to worry about warm season nutrient availability for your animals. Late gestation, lactation, antler growth, it matters. If you haven't already done something, there's some things you could rush out and do now and start planning better for your cool season food plot, certainly. But if you haven't done anything yet, get worried and realize that next year you better be doing something well in advance of this time. Don't let this happen again.
Yep. Now is a great time to start planning for next year.
So get out there on your property where you hunt. Get out there with a chainsaw. Cut some hardwood trees down when you can. Take a soil test or two. And everybody in your state that has an extension service, and most every state has an extension service, that is where you would turn your soil sample into, and they'll analyze it for you and give you your results. There are also some third-party people now that you can see in hunting magazines, and other companies will provide that service as well. But it's very, very cheap. I don't think I've ever seen a soil test cost more than $10 a sample. And in Mississippi, it's $8. We had to go up 2 years ago from $6 to $8. But that's the best $8 you will ever spend. It drives me nuts that you're going to spend hundreds of dollars on the seed and the time to spend $8 every 2 to 3 years.
Hundreds of dollars wasted on fertilizer that can't be used anyway.
Talk about return on investment. That is high ROI.
Amen, bro.
Well, guys, I'm getting ready to enjoy some summer weather in the next week, but I'll be on a beach.
Be careful. Some parts of you are more susceptible to sunburn than others.
I will be under an umbrella, and I do know how to use the sunscreen, so I'll make sure I take appropriate measures. All right, anything else?
Been a great conversation, gentlemen.
Yeah. Great.
Okay, we'll see you next time on Deer University. We're glad you joined us today and hope you learned something valuable about deer management. If you have questions about this podcast or a question about a topic we haven't discussed, please log on to msudeerlab.com, click on the Deer University tab, and send us your questions. We'll get to them as soon as possible. In closing, we want to thank our employers, the Mississippi State University Extension Service and the Forest and Wildlife Research Center. We also want to thank the St. John and Dudley Hutchinson families for their endowments that support deer research and education.